It's the illustrious from high above Wyoming mainstream media. Joined by Mr. Misdemeanor himself, the Saratoga Sledgehammer. Starting your day the right way on the Independence Network. It's time for the morning show with your hosts, David Iverson and Jailbird Joey.
Morning and welcome back to the morning show. It's Friday. I'm David Iverson from Cowboy State Politics, and I'm joined by my partner in crime, the Saratoga Sledgehammer. If you want to get arrested, show up with Joey Carrenti. How's it going this morning, Joey?
Actually, let me correct that. I've never really been arrested. I've been charged a lot, but never put in cuffs.
Not once?
Well, not for at least 15 years. Not for 15 years anyway, but yeah, all the things people like to attribute to me, there either was no court case, or even if there was a court case, there was no actual arrest. Most of my problems come from people in the prosecutor's office coming up with a good idea months later and then putting me on paper, but I never go through the process of being booked into jail for it. So 50-50, but trouble is trouble. And I'll tell you, I got to stay in the house today. I did not sleep well at all last night. Had nightmares all night long because somebody sent me the actual mugshot of Christy Haswell. And I'll tell you, that image stuck with me and haunted me all night long.
Isn't that the most horrible thing you've ever seen? Well, perhaps not ever seen, but it's pretty bad.
You know, we lead with our mistakes, and I don't think it was a mistake, but when we pointed out that the Sheridan Press had not used that mugshot, they used a file photo. Now I know why. I mean, this is something that if you posted it on Facebook would probably go behind the little hidden, you know, violent or disturbing images, view image anyway, and you'd have to click on it to see it. It is a rough picture. And she's got this look on her face where she's almost telling you with her facial expression, her eyes, you know, all I hear out of that picture is, "It's ma'am." And it is a tough picture to look at. Maybe we'll get that up for the listeners, but I don't know. We do a morning show and we want people to be well rested and awake when they do it. And I'll tell you, you look at this thing and you're not going to get any sleep for weeks.
No, it's awful. And you know, the first time I saw it, I actually got it late at night, and fortunately I didn't have any nightmares, but I was really concerned about it. I was like, oh my God, that's the most horrible thing I've seen in a long time. But it kind of brings up a good question though, Joey. Why didn't the Sheridan Press release it? I mean, if it were a mugshot of you or me, no matter how bad it was, they would certainly put it on the front page.
Yeah, and they might even go as far as what the Time Magazine or whoever did it with the OJ mugshot and added a filter to make it even look worse. So absolutely, if it was one of us, it would be, you know, all but what they actually were intending or saying they were intending of informing the public, it would be demonization. So I still think they should have used the mugshot, especially knowing what it looked like. I can see why. I mean, we just had a little joke about it, but because they are, you know, the protectors of their little socialist realm there in Sheridan County, I could see why they didn't use it. They want to make this as unnoticeable as possible and sweep it under the rug. And putting that picture out there would definitely make the situation stick in the minds of the people.
Well, and just the look on her face is one of contempt. You know, you could tell that she's staring at the person taking the photo and she just doesn't think that she deserves to be there. I mean, it is the classic red coat look that I'm more important and how dare you take a mugshot photo of me. Now, of course, in the photo, she's not holding up the sign that says, you know, Christy Haswell, like you would see, you know, anywhere else. But it's a pretty terrible photo. She's got a real nasty look on her face that how dare you take a picture of me. And, you know, maybe what we ought to do, Joey, is rig something up on the website where we'll blur out the image. And if you really want to see this, click here. But I think everybody should have seen it. And I think the Sheridan Press should have run with it because they would have done that for anybody else. So why is Christy Antoinette Haswell any different?
It's the facts. It's a public record. It should have definitely been used. And unlike some libraries in Wyoming, we'll go ahead and post that picture definitely in the adult, not safe for children section.
So we're pretty sure that Donald Trump is going to be the nominee. And I mean, he is the presumptive nominee. He's got enough delegates to run away with it. So no question there that he's going to end up being the guy on the November ballot. But it's time we start talking about VP picks. And one of the guys that's, I guess, made the short list is Marco Rubio from Florida. Now, I've never really had anything bad to say about Marco Rubio. I think that he's a great senator. I think he does a great job for Florida. I like a lot of stuff that he says. But me personally, he just doesn't strike me as presidential or vice presidential material. And it's not because of his height. I liked Ron DeSantis, and he's kind of a short guy. Remember, that was that whole kerfuffle during the when he was still in the election about him wearing shoes with big heels on them. You know, whatever. I don't care. But for me, I've never looked at Marco Rubio and said, yeah, I want to vote for you for one of the highest offices in the land. What do you think, Joey?
Well, first, let me point out, I love the long, thoughtful pause you gave just before you said, I don't really have anything to say that's bad about him, when I could tell all the bad things you could say about him were running around in your head and you made the better choice. So good on you, David Iverson. Couple interesting things. One, and we see this a lot of the time in Wyoming elections, it's not always about who could do the job. It's about who can get elected. Those are two really different things. And the vice presidential pick tends to be who's going to help with the presidential election. So I don't know that Marco Rubio would really have too much policy concern in that situation. The office of the vice president has been ever-changing since Dick Cheney went in there and turned it into this legal kerfluffle of power and money. I'm sure it was that way before, but never so obviously since we had Dick Cheney. But I really don't think it's a big deal as far as ability to do the job, what the actual experience is. It's about getting votes. And that's where the problem comes in with not only Marco Rubio, but let's say, you know, back when the very first Republican debate happened, you and I talked. I remember I was driving up to Sheridan listening to it, and we got on the air the next morning on your show, and we talked about it. And I said, hey, listen, what we really need is Trump and DeSantis to settle their grievances. Trump's the nominee because he's got 4 years that he can do this, set up a great future for DeSantis, and then maybe even a Ramaswamy presidential run in the future. Let DeSantis be your VP. We're going to run into the same issue there. Rubio and DeSantis both live in Florida, and they both hold office in Florida. So if Trump picks either of them, it's not necessarily a violation of the 12th Amendment of the Constitution, but a provision of the 12th Amendment of the Constitution will come into play. And let me read that for you. At the very beginning of the 12th Amendment, which was ratified in 1804, so this isn't a new thing, the electors shall meet in their respective states and vote by ballot for president and vice president, one of whom at least shall not be an inhabitant of the same state with themselves. So if you have a president that's running on the ticket with a vice president from the same state, it's legal. It's not unconstitutional, but what it causes to happen is if that ticket wins the state, those electoral votes from that state are not counted towards the presidential total. It basically nullifies the electoral votes from that state. And with there being 30 votes in play in Florida, I don't think that's a mathematical or political risk that Donald Trump would take. There are other possibilities. Specifically with Marco Rubio, he could move out of state. He has a residence in D.C. Obviously, he's a senator. He could do that, and it would kind of fix the issue with the electoral votes, but he would have to resign his Senate seat, which would put DeSantis in a position of being able to choose the replacement, fill that vacancy in the Senate, and I don't know that that's something that Donald Trump would really sign up for either.
So
there's
a
lot of things in play.
I have a question. So in national politics, it matters where you live. I mean, I thought you could have a house anywhere and represent any district you wanted. You know, you could live in Lander and represent Cheyenne. So actually, that sort of stuff really does matter. I'm so confused.
Well, what it really comes down to, and I hear what you're saying, David, is what level are you running at and what are the rules that govern that level? And yes, at just about every level I've seen, all the way down to precinct representative within the party, if you move out of the political subdivision that you currently represent, you are no longer on the ticket, or you're no longer in that position. It creates an automatic vacancy, as does the legislature, which we've seen and have evidence of at least two pretty serious incidences of that were never enforced the way the law is written. But there are different rules at different levels for being able to run. Now, if you remember back to, when was it, 2020, 2022, we had a Senate candidate from Pennsylvania who had never lived in Wyoming, never stepped foot in Wyoming, and never came to Wyoming, and it was completely legal for them to run. Had they won the general election, not the primary election, they would have to have a residence in Wyoming before they took office, and they would have to maintain that residence in Wyoming the entire time they had office. The presidential, vice presidential ticket, a little different, as we see here in the 12th Amendment. You can't be living in the same state at the same time, but there's nothing saying Marco Rubio can't move, change his address, legitimately live in DC at his residence there, and then switch back, but he would have to give up his Senate seat. So you're right. There are rules at different levels, but most all of them say either while running or while serving, you have to have or maintain a residency in that political subdivision, which totally makes sense. You know, pretty soon we're going to see people from other countries running for positions because it doesn't matter where you live. And obviously Wyoming doesn't care about, you know, citizens being the only ones allowed to vote or run for office. So that's a potentiality. If we don't fix, you know, some of the problems here in Wyoming with the way we apply the law or even have the law written, yeah, we're gonna have a lot of people that aren't from here, don't live here, have never been here, potentially representing us in almost any position you can think of, because there's no law that is enforced that goes against that activity. So you're right, it's funny, but it's also pretty serious when it comes down to it.
Sure. Now, as far as like Marco Rubio's political bona fide, or, you know, conservative bona fides, I don't think we have any question about that. I can't offhand think of any position that I really disagreed with Marco Rubio on. He does have the whole immigrant factor coming on there. I mean, his family did move here from, he's from Cuba, right?
Yes, sir.
You know, so there's that. And, you know, maybe the Trump campaign is thinking, well, you know, we got a big problem with illegal immigration. Might be interesting to have a guy whose family is, you know, first generation immigrants to the United States. So that's interesting. But like I said, he's never really struck me as, you know, the guy I see as the vice president of the United States. But there again, most of us probably never thought that Donald Trump would be president ever also. So politics makes strange bedfellows, and we'll just have to see on that one. Have you heard of anybody else that's on the short list?
I do know he's looking at Tulsi Gabbard, which is another interesting pick. I'm not as familiar with her background. I just know that she was a Democrat for a while and then went independent and all these other things. And I believe there's some political capital in both of those candidates. You're going to get some demographics more interested in your campaign than if you didn't have them. But, you know, every plus has a minus to it. Let's talk about Marco Rubio for a second. Okay, you've got, the immigrant factor, but that's not a blanket. It's not everyone who is ever immigrants. Remember that Cubans don't get along very well with Puerto Ricans, and both of those groups don't get along very well with Mexicans. So you're not going to get every Latin America vote moving over to your side because you have a first generation immigrant family, specifically because he's Cuban. So you got to do the math on the political capital. And I don't know if what they had risked with Rubio would be worth it. Same thing with Tulsi Gabbard is, yeah, you might get a lot of those people in the middle. And there's a lot of argument that it is the undecided middle of the spectrum voter that really makes these ultimate decisions on who's going to be the president. But you might lose a lot of your intense conservatives. I think Donald Trump has a better chance of rolling those dice because the conservatives will vote for Trump almost, regardless of what else he does. But there's some of those purists that are going to say, no, you can't pick someone from the other side and really have our vote. And then there might be, I don't know, it wouldn't be an October surprise. It would just be a media campaign saying, you know, oh, this is how you true hardcore conservatives, this is how conservative your presidential pick is. You pick a former Democrat who's, you know, an independent, has all these other issues. I'm sure they'll come up with some dirt on her. And it depends on, you know, is the cost worth the value? Are you going to get out of it? Like I said, the votes you would expect to gain with your vice presidential pick by picking any of these people. So we'll just kind of have to wait and see what President Trump decides to do, who he decides to choose, and how that math works out. But I'll also say it's worked well in the past sometimes. Ronald Reagan was not always a Republican. And as early as the late 50s, early 60s, kind of started that conservative revolution and used the fact that, hey, I was a Democrat for a long time. I was blind. I didn't really see what was going on there. Now that I'm looking at the principles and the actions of the party, there's no way I can be a Democrat. So it can be spun or worked in any direction. I don't see anybody that stands out to me as an extra reason for me to vote for Trump. You know, I'm not looking at any of these VP picks saying, oh, that's a good ticket. Then again, I felt the same way when he ran with Mike Pence. I'm like, eh, well, yeah, now you're getting the dry white toast vote because you have Mike Pence on the ticket. But that may be what he needed to get over the bar and become president back in 2016. So I don't know yet. I have to see a little bit more. And remember, we're only heading into the primary season, and Trump has already defeated all of his opponents for the primary. He's already the presumptive nominee for the RNC, and all 29 delegates from Wyoming have already been assigned to him for at least the first two rounds of voting. So unless something spectacular comes up in the news, I'm not going to really spend a whole lot of time keeping an eye on what Trump's doing, because right now it's just building that that war chest and you know, getting the exposure he needs to counter any of the other negative media coming his way.
You know, Tulsi Gabbard's interesting. I mean, I like a lot of the stuff that she is saying now. I do think that there's political capital in her being a former Democrat who's turned independent, who's, you know, turned podcaster, whatever you want to call it. But I think that it's important to look at the record of whomever Trump is going to choose. Tulsi Gabbard is not a conservative, nor has she ever been. Now, while she may be disenchanted with the Democrat Party, that doesn't mean that she's, you know, changed her spots on, you know, any of these other issues. She was a big climate change proponent there while she was in Congress. So there's a lot of considerations that go into picking a vice presidential pick. I don't necessarily think it's a problem if you're running for an office and you have, you know, very different viewpoints from your partner in crime or your running mate. The problem comes in the policies that are going to be executed. Now, if the vice president was going to follow the mandates of the Constitution, well, then the vice president really doesn't do a whole heck of a lot. But considering how you started this segment, which was, now remember what Dick Cheney did to the vice presidency, I think a lot of those other considerations come into play. Biden, and I know we shouldn't use Biden as a standard for anything with the presidency, but he tapped Kamala Harris to be the immigration czar, who never visited the border. And she's held several other positions of alleged responsibility in the administration. So things being what they are now, the vice president does have considerably more power, legal or not, than they used to. So I think it's important to look at the record of whomever he's going to choose, whether it be Marco Rubio or Tulsi Gabbard or Kristi Noem. I've heard her name batted about a little bit. Tim Scott, I've heard, you know, he might be a choice. So there's a lot of things that go into choosing a vice presidential candidate. To be honest with you, Joey, when Trump chose Mike Pence, I really didn't know that much about him. And as it turned out, he was a pretty good vice president in the end. Really didn't come out too popular, as his presidential run explained very clearly. So I think that there's quite a bit of time. before Trump has to pick somebody to run with, but it's always interesting to do the war gaming between different candidates. One of the issues that you and I have not really talked about is the constitutional amendment that's going to be on the ballot this upcoming election. And that's to add another class of property, or to separate a class of property, to make residential its own class, that is taxable on its own, and leave commercial property on its own. I know I have a lot of problems with this thing, but why don't we start with you, Joey, and you tell me your issues with this constitutional amendment.
Yeah, let's go ahead and clarify first that the constitutional amendment for the state of Wyoming doing anything, any constitutional amendment, will be on the general election ballot. Now, I know a lot of our listeners would never miss an election, but if you look at some of the stories going on across Wyoming, about 28% of Wyoming voters have been scrubbed from the voter rolls, and most of that is due to non-participation in the last general election. So a lot of people believe that because most of the races in Wyoming are decided at the primary, they don't have to vote in the general, but it does a couple things. One, it scrubs you from the voter rolls, and you get all this Gail Simmons insanity of, people don't know, they need to register. Well, you need to know. If you don't vote in every general election, whether it's a presidential year or not, you're getting scrubbed from the voter rolls. For some of my Democrat friends, if you die, you're not allowed to vote anymore. That's a rule in Wyoming. Sorry if it's unfair, but that's the way we do it here. If you get a felony, if you move out of state, there's things that'll get you scrubbed from the voter rolls. But the biggest one is non-participation. And the constitutional amendments only come up on the general election ballot in November. And this year, we probably won't have that big of a problem because it's a presidential election year. But anytime there's a general election, you need to make sure you're voting on that one too, because there could be, I don't know, judge retention. There could be constitutional amendments, lots of other things, property tax, what do they call it, that special use tax increases. Those are all on general election ballots. So if they're not in a special election, which you also need to vote in, make sure you're voting in November no matter what or who's on the ballot. Now, specifically with this one, regardless of any of the perceived property tax relief that we received in the last session, I believe there were four or five bills that passed, all of them have a sundown and will be gone by 2026. And the last time you'll see the benefit is in your bill in 2027, with the exception of the Veterans Ad Valorem tax reduction rate, which is historically, if you're a veteran and you have 30% disability or more, I believe, you get $3,000 off of your assessed value. They increase that to six, and that $6,000 assessment reduction will stay. Everything else, every other tax bill, is only good through the next budget session, basically. So what we're going to see is a continued effort to get some kind of property tax change. I'm not going to call it relief in there. And one of the earliest ideas was a constitutional amendment that says we can separate these classes of property and manipulate them individually. Now, in my mind, I always like to do a visual. I see it like my little soundboard here in the studio, or each one of these channel sliders is an individual class of property. And you have to move them all pretty close, you know, the same way you do sound. They can't be one's way up and one's way down, and you expect it. So the current law says all classes of property tax must be within a certain percentage of each other. But the new constitutional amendment separates out some of those properties that are joined, like commercial and residential, on the same slider to their own slider. And it increases the differential you can have between them. And the argument is, we're doing this so that we can bring property tax way down and allow the rest of them to pick up the slack. Well, we heard arguments against that from the people that say that this constitutional amendment's an idea that should be, you know, adopted by the people. During the session, we heard you cannot lay the tax burden on industry over private property ownership. Well, these are the same people that are pushing for this constitutional amendment to separate your residential property out, and you might see a couple of years where they bring it way down. But it also gives them the ability to leave industry at the tax rate it's at and jack your private property rates way up in the future. It's just a bad idea. I don't like that they would even have the ability. Whether they would do it or not, that's a totally different story, but it allows them potentially to leave everything else in the state at the current rate it's at, and just like Rocky Mountain Power saying, no, we have plans and we have construction and all this other stuff we need to do, so we're going to go ahead and just raise the rates on the homeowners for your taxes so we can pay for all this stuff because we got bills now, but everybody else is going to stay the same. And in that alone, the fact that there is still no discussion about reducing spending, it's all about manipulating tax and revenue, that makes me say, no, it has to be a no. This is one of the last protections we have against the government in being in only the bad position we're in now with our property taxes. We do this, and I guarantee you within 3 years, it's going to be worse than it is right now on property taxes because there's still that looming death of Wyoming based on school spending that they're going to have to recoup somewhere and keep those elevators paid for every budget session. And that has to come out of property taxes because they're unwilling to do anything else, including reducing spending. So if you happen to get a chance to look at your general election ballot, vote no. My opinion, vote no on this constitutional amendment.
Yeah, definitely nay on Amendment A. But there's a lot to unpack with this whole thing. You see, the guys that wrote that portion of the Wyoming Constitution were absolutely brilliant in tying commercial and residential property taxes together. Because it prevents the legislature from independently monkeying with the tax rates. Right as it sits right now, businesses cannot be taxed any more than your home is taxed. And similarly, you can't tax your home any more than you're going to tax businesses. Now, think about this from the national perspective. You always hear the Democrats say, businesses don't pay their fair share. The rich need to pay more. Well, in Wyoming, as far as property taxes are concerned anyway, that's a non sequitur. That's a conversation that doesn't happen because commercial property is taxed exactly the same as residential. So you can't independently manipulate either one of them. So as Joey pointed out, this constitutional amendment would allow them to monkey with the tax rates. They could jack up residential property taxes. They could jack up the commercial real estate taxes. So it was actually a pretty good move for the guys that wrote this part of the Constitution to do it the way that they did. Now, if this thing is approved, yeah, they could independently change either one of them. And in my personal opinion, any conversation about taxation that doesn't include spending isn't a conversation worth having. Because until you're going to get a handle on the crazy amount of money that our state spends, there's no sense in even talking about taxes. Because eventually they're going to find another tax to recoup that revenue. What we heard all session long was, well, we have to backfill this revenue. You know, if we take money over here, you know, or the worst one that I found particularly insane, or not insane, but offensive, was, we can't afford this tax break. Excuse me? It's not your money, all right? Everything that the state spends is our money. It's all tax dollars. And so first, you're spending a crazy amount. This past session, we put $700 million in the bank account. So that's $700 million that they took in excess of what they needed. Now, needed, that's kind of a loaded term because they spent a crap load of money on stuff that we absolutely don't need. But just all of the measures that they passed in the budget, over and above that, they had $700 million left over. So the question is, if this constitutional amendment passes and we separate out residential property taxes, and let's say they do the right thing and they follow through on all of their, you know, the litany of vacuous promises that they all uttered to get this thing passed, and they do lower residential property taxes. Well, the very next question you should ask yourself is, what taxes are they going to raise? Because you know that they're not going to cut spending. They've proven that the last two sessions. There is absolutely nowhere where they're interested in cutting any sort of spending. The only thing that they might be willing to do is to decrease the rate of increase. So I know that sounds a little confusing, but a spending cut means that you are cutting spending off the baseline of where your budget is at. You're not spending as much as you were last year. What their version of spending cuts are is saying, well, we're still going to spend more. We're just going to not spend as much. I mean, it's absolutely bizarre. Whenever politicians talk about cutting spending, really what they mean is cutting the rate of increase. So when you factor all that into this whole constitutional amendment discussion, it means that they are going to backfill that decrease in tax revenue from residential property taxes somewhere else. And my guess is they're thinking they're going to tax services, which is what Redcoat Steve Harshman mentioned over and over this past session. Well, you know, Wyoming, we only tax about 50 services. Other states, they tax a lot more services. Now, the services I'm talking about, for instance, that are not taxed are the guy that mows your lawn, hairstylists and barbers. That service is not taxed. Advertising is not taxed. In fact, that's a tax write-off. So there's a lot of things. We don't tax groceries, for example. So there's a lot of things in Wyoming that we don't apply a sales tax to. But I promise you, I'm just listening to what Steve Harshman was saying this past session, they are absolutely thinking about increasing the tax on services. So if they're not going to cut spending and this constitutional amendment passes, they are going to increase taxes somewhere else. We just don't know what the somewhere else is. So when that issue comes up on the ballot, when you see that constitutional amendment, you should absolutely vote no on it.
And let's talk about other tax increases that were already proposed before the big argument or the reality of reducing property taxes came up. Jerry Obermueller, we should apply a delivery tax on everything that comes from Amazon. Only a few years after they started to apply sales tax to anything you buy online. So they've already increased all of the online sales revenue through the taxes by 6% or six, I guess it's a 6% tax when you buy that stuff. And Jerry Obermueller suggested, well, we should have a delivery fee for each of those so that we can start generating more revenue. So that has already been discussed. And just because Jerry Obermueller isn't running again doesn't mean that idea is not coming back. That idea came from the cabal, the Wyoming caucus side, and I'm going to guess at very least Steve Harshman would be willing to pick that up and run with it. Don Burkhart wanted to tax, first it was fuel, then it was fuel and gas, then it was a road usage fee. And all this stuff came up before COVID, before the, inflation really hit Wyoming and increased registration fees, all these different, and there was like five or six different taxes that Don Burkhart himself had brought up before any of this stuff happened. Never a discussion of reduction of spending. And then, of course, our good friend Nancy Case, who is very interested in having an income tax. Again, no talk about reduction of spending. And all of these suggestions and comments were made prior to the current situation we're in. So if you think we're just telling stories out of school and demonizing people or the idea because we want to sound good or whatever, no, this stuff has already been proposed before we were facing this issue. Another interesting point, the over $700 million that we stuffed into savings during the last legislative session, if you break that down, that's about $1,500 for every man, woman, and child in the state of Wyoming. That's half a drag show. Let me put it, you know, half a drag show that the state's already spending. I don't know that anybody's tax rates are at above or below $1,500. I know that that would alleviate most people's tax burden entirely. And even the really rich people, that'd be a nice little bonus. You want to talk about tax? Stop putting money into savings that belongs to the people, because we're talking about either a significant amount of money to most Wyomingites or amount of money that doesn't already matter to the super rich. I hate at any level taxation not based on just a flat percentage. And I know you call it a regressive tax, and I agree to a point, but I still think that the fairest way of doing it is stop taxing income at the state and federal level, be a consumer-based society, and have flat rates on purchases. None of this ongoing property tax stuff. When you buy a house, it's this percentage of the value of your home at the time of purchase paid off over the length of your mortgage. You get a bill saying you owe $23,000 over the next 30 years, and you can pay it off the same way you pay annual property taxes. But once the bill's paid, it's paid as long as you occupy that home. So taxes are going to start to get more and more sticky, and the way that we kind of throttle back what did you call it? Decreasing the increase.
Yeah, decrease in the increase.
The rate of increase. Yeah. Yeah. What I see that as is you're just slowing the bleeding. You're not stopping the bleeding. You're not saving the life. There's still a chance catastrophic things could happen. We are just slowing the bleeding. We're still bleeding, and we still have a potential to perish from that bleeding, even though it may have been slowed. So this only helps accelerate that if you vote for this constitutional amendment. And I don't think this is the last time we're going to talk about it as it gets closer. I think people really need to look at what the possible effects are and realize that if you're for the change in property taxes, you're for the constitutional amendment, you should still vote no, and then just open up your wallet and cut a check to the department or resource that you really want to keep having in, I don't know, the state or your community. I talked to State Treasurer Kurt Meyer, and he says, nope, we haven't received any personal checks to any department or program in the state of Wyoming except for the State Fair Board. The only time all these people out there complaining about, we need more money for this, we need better revenues so we can fund this and this good idea that's going to cost this much money, none of those people that complain or run organizations that say it's important ever put together a pool of money and hand it to the state and say, we care so much, we're willing to self-fund this. So there's a lot of options there. It starts with voting no on this constitutional amendment. If you really care, hey, either open up your checkbook and start paying for some of it yourself, or fight with us and say that's not a legitimate responsibility of government and privatize it and do it yourself. And then maybe we can start talking about seeing the reduction in spending, because now the government doesn't have to do it. We're doing it ourselves, and we've eliminated the need for that entire department.
Exactly right. And I mean, there are so many things in the state budget that frankly don't even fit anywhere close to being the proper role of government. we have so much money, we're spending it on drag shows. I mean, it's that ridiculous. And, okay, so that's only $3,000. But still, that's $3,000 that probably would have paid the property taxes for at least two Wyoming homeowners. So there's a lot that goes into this whole tax discussion. And it's helpful to look at all of the ways that you're charged money from the government. And just think about that for a minute. Your license plate fees, your driver's license fee, it goes on and on. I just filed my yearly report for Cowboy State Politics LLC. There was a fee attached to that. And if I had actually made a whole bunch of money this year, which I didn't do too bad, I joke about it on the program being an outrageous profit timeout, but you have to pay a fee everywhere you go. And fees are taxes. And so when the government tells you, well, we want to be able to independently change the rate of taxation of your property, you really have to look at what the other hand is doing. Because the government is never altruistic. They're always trying to find more new and inventive ways to spend your money. And until there's an actual plan where they lay it out and say, look, guys, we are not going to spend this much money on this, therefore, we can lower your taxes. That's the only discussion that's really worth having. Now, just to go back to a comment you made quite a bit ago, that a flat tax is kind of regressive. Yes, I absolutely believe that it is. An increase in sales tax, like if you were to keep everything the way that it is right now, you're not adjusting any fees, we still have property taxes, we still have all of these different things. If you raise the sales tax, that's absolutely the most regressive tax there is, because it affects the people with lesser means a more proportionate amount. So in other words, if you're the person that makes $20 an hour working, or not even 20 bucks, but 15 bucks an hour working at a fast food joint, in a 20% increase in sales tax affects you way more than it does somebody that makes $100,000 a year. Now, to qualify that though, if you are offsetting that with a reduction in taxes elsewhere, so for example, I don't know, you're going to eliminate property taxes and you're going to fund that And I know I'm getting into the Steve Harshman conversation here, but I'll qualify that in a minute. But if you're going to eliminate property taxes and we're going to fund that, now we're just going to tax on sales tax. Well, that's not really regressive because it's not a tax increase, right? Because you're actually decreasing the overall tax burden for the citizen. Now, let's go to House Bill 203, which that's the one that everybody got fired up about. We're going to eliminate property taxes for most Wyoming citizens, and we're going to fund it with a sales tax. One of the reasons that that whole thing is bad is who brought it? Steve Harshman. Okay, Steve Harshman has been talking about a statewide income tax for 20 years or more. This past session, he was talking about taxing services. So you have to look at what's going to happen after a piece of legislation is passed. So with House Bill 203, it wasn't just what was in the bill itself. It was all the other ancillary effects afterwards. We know who proposed it. We know what sort of games that guy plays with taxes. And he already tried to push a tax on, it was streaming services that he tried to get pushed through. That's the one that everybody voted yes until they realized that the conservatives had killed the measure, and then they all changed their vote. It was that one. So, I mean, you really have to be aware when we're talking about taxes. Don't listen to what the redcoats are telling you, because they're not giving you an honest assessment of where we're at, pun intended. They're not telling you the truth of what their intentions are, you know, increasing the tax on services or sales tax or whatever other crazy new and inventive ways that they've come up with to perpetrate theft on your pocketbook. So you just have to be aware. And as we get closer to the election, we'll cover this whole tax discussion a lot more. And I've already got it planned out. We're going to have interviews with some people that really do understand our tax structure and are able to explain why that constitutional amendment is such a bad idea. Well, let's move on a bit, Joey. There's a new lawsuit against the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. It's almost like a lawsuit a day with the Alphabet Gang. You know, they're trying to screw your life over so much that you know, other states, not Wyoming, because we wouldn't be out in front of any of this stuff. You know, we wait until there's absolutely no exposure to us before we step out in front. Oh, wait, no. It's follow the leader with Mark Gordon. But the ATF is proposing a new rule, or they've actually issued a new rule, about universal background checks. And this comes to us from John Solomon's Just the News. John Solomon is an excellent investigative reporter. And his news site, Just the News, if you want to add that to your daily, you know, news reading, I strongly suggest you do that. But let me just read you the first couple paragraphs, and then we'll talk about it. And I quote, 26 states sued the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and Explosives on Wednesday, arguing a new federal rule it's implementing targets lawful gun owners and is unconstitutional and illegal. Texas and Kansas led two multi-state coalitions. Florida filed its own lawsuit. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton and Kansas Attorney General Chris Kobach announced their multi-state coalitions at a joint press conference in Frisco, Texas on Wednesday. The announcement was the first time Paxton has held a press conference about official state business, blah, 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 skip ahead. The state sued the ATF and the Department of Justice and their effective heads over new ATF rules the Biden administration finalized on April 19th. The administration argues that the rule is implementing aspects of the 2022 Bipartisan Safer Communities Act, spearheaded by John Cornyn of Texas. Let's see here. Joe Biden called for Congress to enact the so-called universal background check legislation, which would require, and here's the meat of it, every private firearm transaction to be regulated by the federal government. So that's every firearm sale. In other words, if Joey, I wanted to sell a gun to you, we would have to go down to the sporting goods store and you would have to do a background check. And here's the real insidious part. In order to do that, you have to transfer the ownership of that firearm to the sporting goods store. And then they register that firearm. That is, they put that number on the background check form, and your previously unregistered gun now becomes registered, And Joey, you have to pass yet another background check where before this rule, I could sell you a gun and it's totally private and there's no background check involved. What say you?
Well, there's just so much stuff here. First of all, if we look at the list of states, I notice I Love Gun Gordon hasn't put Wyoming on this list of the lawsuit yet, which if anything he says is true, including his excuse of vetoing House Bill 125. Yeah, if that holds up to anything, we should already be involved in this lawsuit here in Wyoming. We won't. The standard with Gordon and Bridget Hill is wait until something looks like it's going to go a certain way and then join the lawsuit at the last second. Luckily, that saves us a little money, but it's not standing up for constitutional principles. The scenario you just gave, you want to sell me a gun. We have to go down to the local gun dealer. You have to transfer it to him. I have to qualify. Let's say I don't qualify. First of all, like you said, that gun's already on the list. That's what they're interested in doing, is creating the lists. I don't qualify. They say, sorry, Mr. Iverson, you can't sell this gun to Jailbird Joey. Probably because his name is Jailbird Joey. We should have known that at the beginning and just said no. But then they have to do a background check on you to transfer your own firearm back to you. Let's say for some reason that doesn't go well. They now own your firearm. I get that that would be a willful exchange, but I still think that's somewhere a violation of the Fourth Amendment. You have to give up your property in order to sell your property, and you might not get your property or proper, market value of it back. I see that as an issue. Now let's talk about the list for a second. The government loves sneaking in the possibility to create lists, track firearms, and the individuals who own them or are interested in them across, you know, the entire nation. That's not the only list they're creating. They're also creating a list of the transaction. We just talked about taxes. I have no doubt that this will also turn into a David Iverson sold a firearm to Jailbird Joey and he got this much money. We need our federal income from that. Give us our taxes. So across the board, bad idea, bad outcome for the people. A lot of guns, I don't have any doubt, are going to be lost to the system. And just the possibility of you attempting, believing you're a legal gun owner and probably being a legal gun owner, but some weird thing on a list or on a regulation somewhere says you can't even own your gun, trying to sell it to me, them saying I can't own your gun, and them not being able to give it back to you under threat of, you know, federal prosecution or whatever. It's just a big old bag of gun grabbing, taxing, list building. I can't even comprehend the levels that this is going to go to. And if it was really important and really constitutional, then it would go through Congress. This is the problem I have whenever a law or the creation of an agency says the agency will propagate rules, because it turns into stuff like this. And Congress never has a say, and it's an absolute violation of constitutional liberties on multiple levels, including the possibility that you may end up losing your property over it, not even believing that you've done anything wrong. The only person that'll get away with doing all this background check, gun transfer, rubber stamp is, you know, if we happen to be Hunter Biden, then we could do whatever we wanted, even on the paperwork. But the rest of us, I guarantee you, we're already on lists where when we submit a background check, we're flagged for something. Even though we've never done anything wrong, there's no reason why we couldn't have firearms. We would already be told, at very least, sorry, we're going to have to wait a week or two before they manually process your request. And no, during that time, you can't have your gun back, even though you're the one selling it. You owned it and possessed it, but you've now transferred it to us. So we're going to have to hold on to this for a while.
Exactly right. And, you know, there is absolutely no restriction on me selling you a firearm. Now, unless, of course, I know that you're a felon or there's some other reason that you can't own a firearm. Okay, so all of those things aside, there is absolutely nothing that prevents me from selling my private property to you. And, you know, the Second Amendment is very, very clear. It says, shall not be infringed, period. I mean, it doesn't say, except in cases of maybe when you're selling a firearm. It doesn't say anything like that, okay? So there is absolutely no restriction. And the problem here is that, just like you said, the government is very interested in creating lists. If this is a form of de facto gun control. And secondly, we already have universal background checks. Okay, if you buy a firearm at a gun show or at a store or The only place that this doesn't apply is in a private transaction. There is a background check. Okay, it doesn't matter if you're buying a 22 or if you're buying a, you know, a 300 Weatherby Magnum or a 357. It doesn't matter. There is a background check if it's a firearm. If I call my sponsor, Gunrunner Auctions, shameless plug here, I have to do a background check. There is literally no way of getting around it. And let me tell you how specific their rules are, Joey. If a gun dealer makes one mistake on a firearms form, just one simple, innocent mistake, their federal firearms license can be revoked. Let me give you a classic example, a perfect example. So I go into Shipton's here in Sheridan to buy, I can't remember what I was buying that day. I know it was a pistol. So I put down my address, and I had just recently moved, and put down the old address, and I was like, ah, crap, I don't live there anymore. So I draw a line through it, and I write my new address on there. The guy freaks out, and he goes, no, give that to me. I got to shred it right now. And I'm like, what did I do? And he goes, well, we can't make any mistakes on this form. If you make one error, the form is no good, and it can threaten their firearms license. And so literally what the federal government is trying to do here is be in control of all firearms transactions so that they can create that list that Joey was talking about. And if you want to get down to like their essential goal, it's they want to know where every firearm is at. Now, the big question here is why? And this also has a really simple answer. The reason why they want to know where all your firearms are at and they're so interested in gun control is they're about to do something to you that you would shoot them for. That's the purpose behind gun control. And so it's absolutely imperative that if there is any attempt whatsoever, it doesn't matter how small or how insignificant it seems to restrict your Second Amendment rights, you have to fight against it. I mean, there's no question in this matter. The Second Amendment says what it says, and it means what it means, and there is no common sense gun control. That's a stupid line that liberals use to try to convince you to do things that take away your liberties. And so this universal background check thing, it is just another attempt. And frankly, it's one that they've been after for a very long time. But I have no doubt with the Supreme Court that we have right now that this universal background check law will be struck down just like all of their other gun control efforts. And, you know, while we're on the subject, Joey, this is probably a good place to explain what the Bruin test is. So recent Supreme Court decision, it's called Bruin. And the court said that any gun restriction has to comport with our historical regulation of firearms. So in other words, if what you're proposing isn't something the founders would have proposed themselves, then that regulation is unconstitutional. And it's literally no more complicated than that. So any of these things that come up, just ask yourself, you know, would the founders have said we need a list of all guns? No, absolutely they wouldn't have. In fact, they'd be the ones that would probably shoot you for proposing it. So, you know, I mean, it's this whole thing is just another example of in a long list of things the Biden ATF has done.
Yeah, as we know, the founders were huge on just letting the government or the crown assess whatever taxes they want. So when it comes into now you have to pay income tax on your gun transfers, I'm sure they'd be against that too. I don't know. I haven't talked to George Washington in a while, but I'll check with him and see how he feels. Let me put on my Mr. Procedural Process and Conspiracy Theorist hat. I wonder how this would work for estates and probate, because the individual who owns those firearms is deceased. And once you're dead, you have no more constitutional rights, but you still have a record. So would it be the individual who owned the guns last that would have to pass the background check in order, I don't know, to sell, transfer those firearms? Would it be the estate, which has no rights at all? Or would it be the probate officer, which has nothing to do with the actual ownership of any of that property? And I'm talking about the situation where the firearms have to come back because the intended recipient is no longer allowed to own fire. I think there's so many levels that this is going to affect that they're either not thinking about, not talking about, or willfully saying, yeah, screw those people too, that it's beyond problematic. And I'll tell you, a lot of gun transfers do happen through probate and estate transfers. Somebody dies, they have their collection at home, grandpa wills it to, you know, Bobby Jr. or whatever. And just the process of saying, who's in charge? Is it who's in possession? Is it, I don't know, the estate is the property of the court until such time as, there's just way too much in there for me to say, oh yeah, we can find a way to make this okay. And really what I see happening is eventually the scales being tipped to the side of whoever the buyer or recipient is, regularly being told no, or we're going to have to manually process this, so it's going to take 2 to 3 weeks every time any firearm is transferred, so that now the physical possession being 9/10 of the law, is out of the original owner or the intended recipient's hands. And then things like, oh, well, we lost this, or we didn't do this properly. And it's just a huge debacle. But the big problem is, for me, the lists, what they intend to do with them, and the fact that I don't think this is well thought out at all. Otherwise, they would have been sending it through Congress.
Well, there's no way that they would get it through Congress, which is why they're using an administrative rule through the alphabet gang. But I can answer that question for you, Joey, because another shameless plug for old Scott Weber at Gunrunner Auctions. So when someone dies and they have a will, then it's those firearms are property of the estate. And so whomever is the executor of that estate, they can give those guns to whomever they want, because it's a private transaction. But if they're going to be sold, well, then if it's a private sale, like an auction or something, those guns have to go through the background check process. But an estate is just like a private individual. They can sell a car, gun, whatever. But if it's a probate, I'm not exactly sure how that works, because all the property has to go through probate, and I'm sure it still stays in the family. But there's, Joey's right, there are so many regulations surrounding firearms, and it's all of them are an attempt to get guns on a list, figure out who owns them, where they're at, and it is the worst kind of government overreach, taking away your means to protect yourself from the government. And it's absolutely shocking, and we should fight against it in any way, shape, or form. So we've got about 3 minutes left. Is there anything else we got on our list today, Joey?
Oh, nothing worth really getting into too deeply, but I will mention, anybody who's got an issue with the student loan forgiveness plans that President Biden has been pushing in violation of the Supreme Court order on his previous actions, might be delighted to know that the group that's the loudest begging for student loan repayment relief, Generation Z, that's anybody born between 1997 and 2012, I believe, are largely being left out of President Biden's plans, as his current attempt to get the taxpayer to pay for your neighbor's useless education is now focused on student loans that are 20 to 25 years old, or anybody who's worked in public service for over 10 years, which largely Gen Z would not be applicable for. So I'll have to keep an eye on that. I think all of it's ridiculous. If your education was worth anything, you should be able to make the money back to pay the loan you chose to take out. But it's just hilarious to me that the group that thinks they're going to suffer the most and that they're the most entitled are the ones specifically being left out of the new unconstitutional plan of your great leader, Joe Biden.
Well, if you're the idiot that rang up $120,000 worth of student debt for a degree in underwater basket weaving, you have nobody to blame but yourself. And you should be responsible for taking the loan that you agreed to take and that you agreed to take back. There's no reason why I, Joey, or anybody else should be shouldered with your dumb decision debt. This is absolutely a vote-buying scheme, and it's fascinating that the votes he's trying to buy are the very people that are not going to be beneficiaries of his program.
Yeah, let me point out, back when this was still being discussed and a possibility, I was still paying my student loans, and I paid off my student loans about a month before the decision looming in the Supreme Court came out saying, hey, we're not paying your student loans, but I've got the certificate. I think I sent it to you the day I finally paid off my loans back in 2021, 2022. I was very proud of the fact that I did that on my own, even though there was a possibility that the, you know, my fellow taxpayers would have taken care of that for me. I still did it. And believe me, you don't want to live in a world where you're the guy that won't do the right thing that Jailbird Joey already did himself. So just think about it that way. And yeah, we'll leave it there.
All right. Well, we got 45 seconds left. Coming up on Cowboy State Politics, just kind of a wrap up of everything that happened this week. On the podcast tomorrow, I've got a breaking story of more shenanigans at Cheyenne South High School. So I've got the documents, I've got the pictures. So tomorrow on Weekend Update, it's going to be a rocking good time. Joey, close us out.
Well, make sure you strap in and tune in all week next week for the morning show, as we're going to start our candidate review for the 2024 primary election season. And I'll be spending most of my day today researching that. So an old program of Just Blame Joey Live coming up right after Cowboy State Politics.
You are listening to the Independence Network.